Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. On today's show, a woman's experience after ICE detained her husband.
Our whole life is here, me and my husband. My husband got here when he was 17. I got here when I was 15.
Wyoming has submitted some novel ideas to try to get a slice of $50 billion federal dollars to transform healthcare.
We're looking at designing and procuring a non-emergency transportation and coordination platform.
We hear details and what happened during the arraignment of the man who brought a wolf into a bar.
I'm here for the live stream of the Cody Roberts arraignment.
Okay, yeah. We're not going to allow the backpack.
Okay.
Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Hey, Casper. Join Wyoming Public Media reporters for some coffee and conversations. If you're in the area, come share feedback, give us a news tip, and get to know us. Join us from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Monday, November 17th at the Downtown Metro Coffee.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. Cody Roberts, the man who brought a wolf into a bar in Daniel after allegedly running it down with a snowmobile nearly 2 years ago, made his first public comments this past Monday. At his arraignment for a felony charge of animal cruelty, he pleaded not guilty. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan was in the Sublette County Courthouse. Caitlin, tell us about it.
Yeah, so, you know, there's been a lot of buildup to this hearing, but it was honestly pretty anticlimactic. It was actually held virtually, but there was an in-person viewing. And Nikki, I'm sad to say we don't have any sound from the hearing itself because the judge didn't permit it. In fact, he started off the hearing saying that if any recordings leaked of the proceeding, there won't be any remote options in the future.
And that's not terribly unusual for a judge to say no recordings.
Right. I know. But, you know, I did record myself giving it my best shot. I actually walked up the stairs of the Sublette County Courthouse to the district court where I was met by security guards.
I'm here for the live stream of the Cody Roberts arraignment.
Okay, yeah. We're not going to allow the backpack.
Okay.
So you need to leave that in your car.
Okay. Could. Yeah, absolutely. Can I bring a notepad?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. No phone. Okay, perfect. I'll be right back.
Okay.
No phone, no camera, no nothing.
No phone, no camera, no nothing.
All right.
We'll be back.
So I walked into the courtroom with just a pen and paper in hand. But again, this was a virtual arraignment, meaning the judge, Roberts, and his lawyer and the prosecutor were all meeting on a video call. I also counted 22 other people who were tuning into that video call, but you had to sign up early to do that. Otherwise, there was an in-person viewing of the call, which is what I did. So I watched the proceedings on a big TV screen in the courthouse with just a handful of other journalists. You also could just listen in to the audio on a live stream, but I was told that actually never ended up working.
Yeah, I was trying to tune into that audio stream, but it seems like watchers crashed the system.
Yeah, and honestly, that checks out. You know, this incident has been intensely watched all over the world. It all started back in February 2024 when Roberts allegedly ran down this wolf with a snowmobile, but it was still alive. And different footage from that night shows Roberts posing with the wolf at a house, and the wolf has red duct tape wrapped around its muzzle. And then later there's footage that shows the wolf being paraded around a local bar. Roberts did get a fine at the time. It came from Game and Fish. It was $250 for illegal possession of wildlife, but that was it. And that was part of what really ruffled people's feathers across the world. The story made international headlines, and things got honestly pretty ugly. There was a lot of threats, even death threats, coming from both sides.
Yeah, your coverage throughout last year focused a lot on that tension, right? Like the calls from outside, calling for something to happen. Meanwhile, the town kind of rallied around Roberts and his family. And it was heated enough that the Associated Press reported that Roberts initially avoided more serious charges because investigators were struggling to find cooperative witnesses.
I mean, it even caught the attention of some state lawmakers, and there was some legislation passed basically upping the penalties if this type of behavior ever happened again. And this case has largely simmered for almost 2 years until now. It actually started with a convening of a grand jury in August. They chose to indict Roberts on felony animal cruelty charges, which means he's facing up to 2 years in prison and a $5,000 fine.
So at this arraignment, what happened?
Honestly, it was pretty procedural and mostly just the judge talking and explaining kind of the ground rules for a court arraignment. Roberts said very little aside from making his not guilty plea. The whole thing lasted about 15 minutes. On the screen, the faces we were able to see were the Sweetwater County District Court Judge Richard Lavery, Sublette County Prosecutor Clayton Milinkovich, and then Cody Roberts, obviously, and then his lawyer, who is Rob Piper out of Coal Creek Law, which is based in Cheyenne. And I should note, that's a switch up. His original lawyer was Elizabeth Trifonis in Jackson, and she's largely known for her immigration work. Otherwise, in the room was four journalists, and then one other person, Peggy Bell. She's a local former middle school librarian to Roberts. And she told me that she was there to support him, and that she thinks he's a good person.
So this case is out of Pinedale in Sublette County, but you said the judge is from Sweetwater County.
Yeah, that was kind of a tricky part that caused actually some confusion initially. So the venue is still Sublette County. If this ultimately goes to trial, from what I can tell, that still means the jury would come out of Sublette County, but the judge is from Sweetwater County. I did a little digging into why that happens. Grant Smith, who's the director of the University of Wyoming's Defender Aid Clinic, told me judges can bow out for ethical reasons, like having connections to the parties, or just because of scheduling issues.
You said Roberts could face up to 2 years in prison, a fine. What are the stakes for him outside of that?
It's important to remember this is a felony charge, which I don't think really sunk in for me until I was sitting there listening to Judge Lavery lay it all out. He spent several minutes just talking about what it means to be convicted of a felony, like not being able to vote or not being able to own a firearm. And Judge Lavery even went into detail about what that could look like. You know, it could be pretty complicated to have a job that requires a firearm or even to hunt.
Did the prosecution or Roberts' defense team give any indication what their arguments will be?
They did not, but the judge did spell out what is in that grand jury indictment, basically saying that Roberts knowingly and with the intent to cause undue suffering tortured or tormented a male gray wolf. And so the judge said that the prosecutor will have to prove all of that beyond a reasonable doubt for Roberts to be charged. And until then, he's presumed innocent.
Where do things go from here?
Yeah, so at the end, there were some housekeeping items. The county prosecutor, Clayton Milinkovich, he said he didn't feel that bond was necessary. Basically, he doesn't think that Roberts is a flight risk, and the judge agreed. There was also just the standard order of no contact with potential witnesses. But as to your question about what are the arguments the different sides are going to make, that is going to become more clear here in the coming months. There's several deadlines coming up in December for discovery, so we'll learn more about who these witnesses are. Grant Smith, again, with UW's Defender Aid Clinic, he said, quote, "This is where the lawyers start earning their dinner." But also what'll happen over the next few months is negotiations between the two sides. They'll likely try to reach a plea deal and keep this ever from going to trial. You know, I should note that the vast majority of state felony convictions are often settled out of court. But if it does go to trial, the date is set March 9th at 9 a.m. with 5 days allotted for it.
Well, Caitlin Tan, thank you so much for sharing your reporting on Cody Roberts' arraignment over this animal cruelty charge.
Thanks for having me, Nikki.
As Wyoming's legislative budget session draws closer, the Wyoming Business Council surveyed some 500 likely Wyoming voters on how they feel about the state's economy. The Business Council is the state economic development agency, and Josh Durrell is its CEO. He said he hopes the results can help state leaders make sound decisions. Before we dive into the survey's results, I wanted to ask you about some economic myths that the Business Council has listed on its website.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Wyoming is broke.
That is a myth. Wyoming has a tremendous amount of wealth, and Wyoming has a lot of money that we can utilize for difficult situations like we find ourselves in right now.
On the flip side, the state economy is doing just fine.
That's a little bit of a myth. We are actually in a little bit of decline. It's been long-term decline, in fact. What we find is that not only is GDP stagnant or dropping, but things that most people feel every day are actually not doing as well as we think. Our wage growth, it's actually dropping. And employment numbers are staying steady or dropping as well. And the number of people who leave our state that are born here is 2 out of every 3 Wyomingites end up leaving the state. And so all of those indicators together tell us that the economy is actually in long-term decline.
The private sector will take care of the economy.
Yes and no. Yes, the private sector has a huge role in our economy, but in terms of doing it all alone, that's just not true. We in rural America, especially in Wyoming, rural places are losing their businesses, they're losing their youth to the larger city centers. And so what we need to do is really think about how do we have private business and government intervention that work together to solve that problem.
And then thinking of government, nobody wants taxes to increase.
Nobody is the key word in that. And that is a myth because there are actually people who say we would favor paying more taxes if the number of jobs increased and we knew what it was going for. I think that level of transparency and creating new opportunities is really the key there. About 35% of Wyomingites polled said that they were in favor of paying slightly higher taxes, which was a bit of a shock to us.
Yeah, I was curious, what else sticks out for you from this year's poll?
Yeah, a few really key indicators I think are important for us to think about. What we found is that there is support for population growth. In fact, 65% said they support growing the population to support new economic opportunities and businesses. 79% favored their town or county taking decisive action to grow jobs and expand the economy. And then I think the most telling stat is that 90% believe that it is important for local government to invest in programs that help retain or attract young people and recent graduates. To me, that's really a Wyoming feeling of we want to keep our families close. We want our children to have opportunities and to enjoy the Wyoming that we all love.
What did your survey respondents see as kind of the biggest issues facing the state's economic success and the barriers to those findings that you just mentioned?
Well, we did ask some questions about how they felt their local economy was today versus about a year ago. And about 75% said that they feel like the economy is doing worse than it was or stagnant. What we found is that people, by and large, want government to invest in job creation and infrastructure for growth. The sexy, exciting things like water and sewer and roads and curb and gutter, those are all really important so that our communities can keep up with growth and instigate that growth that they need for their economy. And I think that that is really important as we think about how does the state government play in what is typically considered a private sector world. And so again, I think those things on trying to increase the number of jobs that are available, as well as the infrastructure that we need in our communities, is incredibly important.
You asked folks about changes that they'd want to see in their town. What came out as winners and losers?
So as we look at what changes people are really saying they need, you know, there is a real strong component about attracting new businesses. About 29% of those that responded that attracting new businesses is important. But the other part that I think is really exciting is the idea of helping our existing businesses expand and grow. 36%, the largest group of people in a community, said they want to take existing businesses and help them grow. As I mentioned, that infrastructure improvements is really important. This is where it also becomes interesting. People thought that it's important for us to take a look at taxes and maybe reform them a little bit in order to instigate that growth.
It looks like almost 2/3 have opposed that, but can you tease apart those responses for me?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, and it's one that we want to dive into deeper. Again, we were actually a little bit shocked that 35% would support slightly higher taxes. However, if we parse the data and look at those folks who answered that they felt their economy was in rough shape. It was almost 50-50 that said they would pay slightly higher taxes for greater economic opportunities. They understand that something's going to have to change. And so, again, taxes is a really challenging issue. There are a number of tools that we have at a local level and in our state that are not being utilized fully that could help us with some of these elements. I think that's the first step to take on our way to maybe restructuring the fiscal system in the long run.
Property taxes obviously are a flashpoint right now. What other tools do you see in the toolbox?
Yeah, so I think there are optional sales and use taxes that need to be fully exercised in our state. One penny of those optional sales and use taxes in our state accounts for about almost $300 million a year in additional tax revenues that we can utilize for that infrastructure, for growth. And so I think what we need to really understand is we have those tools at our disposal, but we're not taking advantage of them. And we really need to so that we can build a thriving economy that, again, gives us that local control. And we can, at a local level, pay for the things that we need to grow our towns.
Do you see Wyoming instituting an income tax?
Gosh, that's probably a discussion for another day. I think what we need to fully understand and help people understand is this economic idea of what is the system going to get if you don't change it. And the system today is really based on that extraction revenue. It has served us very, very well. It has made us a very wealthy state. I don't think that we should throw that baby out with the bathwater. However, I do think that we should open our minds to other tax tools because it's not just about revenue. It's also about what do we incentivize in our state. And today we incentivize low population and high extraction. And so one of the things that we know is that in the future, our economy will likely be based on both extraction and those knowledge sector jobs, which means an increase in population. And so I think it's important for us to realize our fiscal system is a tool that we need to utilize as a way to get what we want. And if we're okay with shipping out 2 out of every 3 kids that are born in Wyoming, well, we should just keep doing what we're doing. But if we're really feeling strongly about families and trying to keep them together and provide opportunities for Wyomingites, we're going to have to take a hard look at other tax tools.
Josh Durrell, CEO of the Wyoming Business Council, thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Up next, a conversation with former Vice President Dick Cheney from our archives. This is Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. As the country mourns former Vice President Dick Cheney's death and grapples with his legacy, we checked back through Wyoming Public Radio's archives to find our interviews with the man who represented Wyoming in Congress for a decade.
Testing 54321, testing 54321.
In October of 1989, Cheney sat down with former news director Bob Beck. Cheney had been Secretary of Defense for President George H.W. Bush for just about a year. He was back in Wyoming to receive the university's Outstanding Alumni Award. Beck caught up with Cheney in WPM Studios for this interview, which we're airing in full.
Fine, and it won't be as formal as the last time. We'll just kind of visit here, and I'll take what you say, what's good, and the crummy things we'll leave out. But I guess the first thing, as you take a look back and when you went to the university for the first time, you know, what kind of things stand out in your mind as you think about UW?
Well, I first came to school here as a student 26 years ago, fall of 1963, and I'd gone to school originally at Yale for a couple of years, but didn't like it, dropped out, went to work, and by the time I came back here, all of my classmates were graduating. I was older than the rest of my classmates, lived on an an apartment on an alley over on Fifth Street, but it was within walking distance, and it cost me $22.50 a month's rent. I remember that first fall because the first time I ever saw a president of the United States was John F. Kennedy. And he came to the campus here in Wyoming and spoke to a big crowd, huge crowd over in the old field house. And then I remember the motorcade afterwards as he left. And, of course, this was just a few weeks before Dallas. I also remember that fall and standing in the student union watching the television set as they announced that the president died the day that of his assassination in Dallas. So it was a different era then, over a quarter of a century ago, but obviously it was a very important part of my life.
As you are where you are now, and you take a look back on those times, any inkling that this is what you were going to do and be this far?
No, what I really got interested in while I was a student here at the university was politics and government, public service. There was a professor in the political science department in those days named Ralph Wade. And he got me involved in an internship, he and Stan Hathaway, who was then the Republican state chairman in the state, and this before Stan ran for governor. They got me involved as an intern in the Wyoming State Senate one session. That was the first political job I ever had. It was fascinating. I enjoyed it. Then Professor Wade had an impact in getting me another fellowship after that took me to Wisconsin, where I worked for a governor, and was part of my faculty advisory team, if you will, when I worked on both my BA and my master's here. An interest originated here during my days at Laramie. I didn't expect at that time that I'd ever pursue a career in politics. When I left Laramie, my plan was to get a PhD in political science and then go teach. I wanted to become a professor. And of course, down the road, the experiences that I had in the Wyoming legislature, working for the governor of Wisconsin, and then in working in the Congress, ultimately led me down the path of a political career instead of a career in political science. But it all started right here at Laramie.
Maybe you can come back someday and try and fulfill that dream.
Maybe I'd come back if they'd have me on campus and sign up to teach.
Yeah, I ask you a little bit about, you know, just what the last year has been like for you. I was just thinking, it was about a year ago this week, the last time I saw you before you became Secretary of Defense, drove up, you and Pete came and visited with me in my office, and you were running for Congress. At that time, did you have any thought, had it come up that this could be a possibility for you?
No, I really I planned to spend the rest of my political career in Congress. I loved being Wyoming's congressman. It was a great job. I'd done it for 10 years, and I had no inclination that I'd be doing anything else. Obviously, after the Tower nomination was defeated in the Senate, that same day I was contacted by General Scowcroft and Governor Sununu, two key advisors to the president, and they first talked to me about becoming Secretary of Defense. The next day, the president actually offered me the job, but it was a surprise. There'd been some speculation before the election last year and some press pieces about the possibility that I might join a Bush administration, but I never gave much credence. It was just press speculation. But it obviously it's a very different October this year than it was last year.
And you take a look at this October, you know, all the things happening in Central America. You've got the Noriega situation. Obviously, it's probably a little more exciting than it ever has been for you since you've been at the Hill.
Well, it is exciting, an interesting time to be Secretary of Defense. There's so much change underway in the world. I mean, if you think about what's happening in Eastern Europe, in Poland, you've got a government headed by a non-communist. The Communist Party of Hungary abolished themselves last week, adopted a new name. We've seen the emigration of thousands of Germans out of the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, to the West. Fundamental change would appear underway inside the Soviet Union, so it is a very interesting time to be there. But it's also a time of great uncertainty. It was relatively easy over the last 40 years at times, if you knew who the bad guys were, to worry about defense strategy and so forth. And now, when there's a great deal of flux and uncertainty about what course the Soviet Union is going to follow, whether or not we'll be able to negotiate arms control agreements, what kinds of weapon systems we're going to need in the future, all of those questions are up for grabs these days.
You know, when you take a look at some of those issues that you brought up, you've obviously been in the limelight. You've made some statements that some even have viewed as somewhat controversial, especially in regards to the Soviet Union. How is it now that you're in the limelight? Is it, do you have to watch what you say? Do you even think about it? Or are you just kind of the same guy?
Well, you have to be cautious in the sense that now I work for somebody else, work for the president. One of the things I really enjoyed about being the congressman from Wyoming was I could say exactly what I thought anytime I wanted to. That's what the people in Wyoming basically liked and wanted to have me do. But I didn't have a boss other than the voters of Wyoming. Once you leave the Hill and you go work in somebody else's administration, once I went to work for George Bush as president, then you really have to adapt your policies to his views. And you get the right to argue inside the administration to help shape those policies. But once he's made a decision, you got to go support it. Now, it's not hard because basically we agree in terms of general direction. But still, nonetheless, as a Secretary of Defense, you do, in fact, have to be more cautious than when you're just one of 435 congressmen, because when you speak with a certain amount of authority, and people pay more attention to what you say.
I want to ask you also, as we take a look back to the 63 time when you came to the University of Wyoming, you mentioned a Professor Wade. Are there other people that played a pretty big role and helped mold you as you got on in life?
Oh, yeah. From the university here, people like Jack Richards, who was for a time the chairman of the department. There was a professor named John Vloyantes, I remember. I took a special tutorial from him. I spent a semester, just the two of us, with a reading list that we worked up together. I read Winston Churchill's six-volume history of World War II, which was absolutely fascinating, which got me interested in foreign policy and national security issues. And then, of course, there were the students that became lifelong friends, many of them from Casper, my roommate before Lynn and I got married, Joe Meyer, who's now the Attorney General over in Cheyenne, Dave Nicholas, of course, who lives here in Laramie, but who's now working for me at NATO headquarters, but who was a student here at Laramie in those days. So those kinds of relationships that you pick up while you're a student here at the university stick with you for a long time.
Distinguished Alum Award. Now, just bring you back to this. What do you think about getting an award like this?
Well, it's a little bit humbling. It's if you had told me when I walked onto the campus 26 years ago, if you told anybody that someday Cheney, who took 6 years to get his BA, will be rewarded with a Distinguished Alumni Award at the University of Wyoming, nobody would have believed it. But it is nice, obviously. It's recognition from people whose views I've got enormous respect for, and to be honored by your home state university and your alma mater in that fashion is a very warm experience.
Mike Schutte doesn't even want to be on the same stage with you. He says maybe they should have a stage for the rest of us and put him up on a higher one.
Nah, Michael Holy's own. Mike's the guy I first met when we were juniors in high school. We both attended Boys State that year, so we've known each other since we were about 17 years old, long time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was former WPM News Director Bob Beck speaking to then-Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney in 1989. Cheney died earlier this month at the age of 84. Big thanks to the American Heritage Center for tracking down this archival conversation and converting it from a cassette tape into a digital file that we can play for you. Cheney's funeral will be held on November 20th at the Washington National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll hear what's happening for one woman after ICE detained her husband.
This time on The Modern West. We start a brand new season about the oddball workarounds Westerners are finding for the affordable housing crisis. We hear stories of people going off-grid in RVs, tiny homes, cars, yurts.
Everybody's looking for a little bit of freedom, a little bit of autonomy. I think that's what people yearn for.
Cheap Dirt. It's season 11 of The Modern West. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Nikki Ouellette. Since March, about 100 people have been transferred to Immigration and Customs Enforcement from Teton County's jail, a pace the sheriff describes as steady. One Jackson resident's husband, a home builder, was detained in July while he was out of town. He has legal work authorization, a clean record, and is working on a pathway to citizenship. He's been here for 3 decades with his wife, who agreed to speak with Jackson Hole Community Radio's Jenna McMurtry and Emily Cohen on the condition of anonymity. We pick up as she shares what it was like when she found out he wasn't coming home.
I was crying, I was shaking, my hands were sweating up because I never drove over there in the big city, and it's like, I don't know what to do. I was like frozen, like. We never been apart before, never ever. Even though he went back for his visas, he have like 5 visas and he was going back and forth from Mexico to here, but it was only a couple weeks and he come back. But this is the longest time that we've been separated. I wish somebody can, like, I have someone to tell me what to do in the moment. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have, like, even though as a family, we talk about this when Trump started with a new administration. We talk, me and my family, like my kids and my husband and I, we need to have a plan B, and a plan C if anything happens. But we didn't talk it deeply until we have this situation. And I wish I had someone at that moment that I can talk to, or they can help me to decide, okay, this is the next step, because I don't know anything. I don't know what to do. I was like frozen, like, what is the next step? What do we need to do? Like, the only thing that we knew, is that Karina told us, I recommend you to get a lawyer. That's it. From then I was like, okay, and what I'm gonna go and talk to the lawyer? What did I have to say to the lawyer? What did I need to say to the lawyer? I don't know anything about, nothing, zero. So he was calling us every day. You had to pay for everything there. Yep, and you had to pay for everything. So for FaceTiming was like almost $7. For phone calls it was like, what, 35 cents or, 35 cents, 40 cents for a call to you. We had to make an account so he can able to call us, so that way we can put money onto his account. Now I can tell somebody, well, this is the next step. If you somebody come and grab your husband, or he goes and have an interview with immigration, this is what you need to do. This is the steps that you need to take. I don't know what's gonna happen, because right now he's gonna have another court. I think a couple more, and we don't know if they're going to give back his permit and his driver's license. We don't know anything right now. And this country has given us a lot, and we're very thankful of this country, and we never say anything bad. Like, I know we going through tough stuff right now because of the president or whatever. But we're always very thankful, and we always said we want to keep living our lives here in U.S. Because we don't, well, right now we don't go back to Mexico. We don't want to go back to Mexico. I mean, our whole life is here, me and my husband. My husband got here when he was 17. I got here when I was 15. So our whole life is here. We're very grateful for this country, because it's given us a lot.
Although the family is together now, they're still awaiting a hearing, and the threat of separation still looms. Wyoming has submitted its application to the federal government for a slice of the new $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Program. The state's 4 priorities are based on input gathered at town hall meetings around the state and surveys. They include funding to increase access to basic care, building the healthcare workforce, improving people's health, and using technology to bring care closer to home. Wyoming Public Radio's news director, Camila Kadelska, caught up with Stefan Johansson, who heads up the state health department, to hear about the specifics, starting with the first bucket, access to care.
What we heard from the public was, with our smaller rural or frontier hospital, we want our emergency department to be there. And that just makes all the sense in the world. But emergency departments are very expensive, especially with low volume, you know, counties or communities. And so you'll see in our critical access hospital basic incentive program, we're really looking at those core services, emergency department, OB, labor and delivery care, emergency medical services, those types of things to say, if you already do those, we want to help invest in the sustainability of those. And if you're not doing those, or if you've recently, you know, had to stop providing services like that, would this incentive program kind of attract that coming back? Because we can now essentially offset or pay for some of that high fixed cost infrastructure to deliver that service that could in the future be less reliant on the volume of billing. Also within that first category, we're looking to expand primary care that integrates behavioral health with physical health or preventive medicine. And I think that's, again, an important point of feedback that we receive from the public, that access to reasonable primary care that also has behavioral health component was a pretty common theme that we heard. And then finally, we've proposed a concept that I think is very interesting. We've proposed both for individuals and for small businesses to design a public health benefit that would essentially protect people who have, emergency care because of an accident, essentially protect them from financial ruin. So we've proposed a benefit plan called Bear Care that we think could be an innovative concept, not as a replacement to the ACA, not as a replacement for private insurance, but as an alternative to folks who might otherwise go uninsured.
Got it. And the second bucket is building up the healthcare workforce. So how are you hoping to do this? Any specifics?
We struggle to solve the out-migration problem where folks go to bigger markets down in Colorado or out west in Utah or up north to Billings or wherever that might be. We really want folks to see this career pipeline coming from Wyoming and staying in Wyoming. So to that end, we're looking at sort of individual education awards in these different trades to let someone, you know, and potentially invest in their CNA program, in their nursing degree, in their medical school for physicians, but a host of other types of professionals in the workforce. And then selfishly on the back end, by nature of that, say this has retention requirements in Wyoming. So you need to stay for 5+ years to essentially, you know, take advantage of that full award. But in addition to that, working with high schools and vocational programs, do folks know this is a career path and also the demand that the communities around Wyoming have for healthcare professionals? You can start young and really build a career in this and also have a way to start a life and raise a family in Wyoming in a sustainable way.
The third bucket, it's improving people's health. That's pretty general. What are some specific ways you're hoping to do this?
First of all, we are very rich in the outdoors. We are very rich in ability to enjoy the outdoors and enjoy physical exercise and those types of things. So both in terms of exercise and diet promotion, we're looking to expand on efforts that the Department of Health has had in the past, but really in a new light, where for nonprofits or charitable organizations that organize things that encourage people to exercise, or, you know, community centers or senior centers that have that type of or want to have that type of service in the winter, for example, when the weather's bad, to be able to provide some cost offsets for them to do that at a higher scale. We've proposed kind of a statewide, what we're calling a telespecialist platform. And this is something we would explore how it could be scaled and how it could be used, really taking advantage of technology to do that. But with psychiatry and with certain types of specialty behavioral health, we know what it's very difficult to have access to those things, especially in interior and rural Wyoming, but that telehealth and telemedicine can really improve our access to that. I'll give you a few examples. We've seen folks with pretty high behavioral needs ending up in the criminal justice system. And just over the last year or two, we've partnered with a lot of sheriffs and detention centers to try to offer at the Department of Health access to a telepsychiatry service where an actual doctor can review and even provide direct care to an inmate of a county detention center, for example, and recommend course of treatments. So we have a little bit of experience with that, and it's exciting with this program to potentially be able to really expand that, but also expand its concept where a huge geography like Wyoming with a pretty small population, those specialty services are just hard to come by. And so if we're approved, we would be looking to scale that up, not just with telepsychiatry, but with other telespecialties.
Okay, and last but not least, the last bucket is using technology to improve chronic disease management and bring care closer to home. I guess you just mentioned telehealth, but any other technology-specific solutions?
We didn't want to be in the position as the state or the Department of Health to pick winners and losers when it comes to technology. So we came up with a program that we proposed in this application called the Technology Adoption Challenge. It kind of flips the script a little bit, and instead of the state picking the, you know, 7, 8, or 9 technology products that we're going to push down from the top down around Wyoming, to really make it bottom up and have provider groups and communities come together and signal their interest. The state, through this program, could provide those sort of matching funds for that effort. So that's number one. And then number two, on the technology side, we're looking at designing and procuring a non-emergency transportation and coordination platform. Something that's exciting, because we know we have basically a state that is one small town with unusually long streets, and getting from place to place can be a challenge and can really restrict access to care. So we're looking to potentially, again, use the power of technology to maybe coordinate a platform that at least makes the logistics and the organization around transportation a bit easier for, you know, our seniors, our disabled communities, and essentially our remote and frontier communities as well.
Anything I missed? Anything you feel like you need to add?
So we're excited with a really creative idea that we came up with to propose to the federal government of essentially what we're calling a rural health transformation perpetuity. So when we talk about access to basic, you know, emergency care at our rural hospitals, OB and labor and delivery care, EMS, ambulance services, and the workforce issue, we would really like to set something up where the state of Wyoming reaps the benefits of that over decades, as opposed to a 5-year funding period. And the way that we think we do that is to invest much more conservatively in the beginning so that we can stretch those benefits out beyond 5 years.
All right. Well, Wyoming Department of Health Director Stefan Johansson, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Good speaking with you.
Coming up, the winter coral season is upon us. We get a preview from Cheyenne. This is Open Spaces.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide 3 music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Wyoming Public Radio brings the news to you in our daily and weekly email newsletters. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Cheyenne Chamber Singers are celebrating their 35th season this year. Wyoming Public Media's Grady Kirkpatrick spoke with artistic director and conductor Sean Ambrose about their upcoming concert on November 23rd and about how the Chamber Singers got started.
Cheyenne Chamber Singers was originally founded as a Dickens chorus for a production of A Mall in the Night Visitors by Cheyenne Little Theater Players. So the very first time that the group performed was at that performance at the historic Atlas Theater in Cheyenne. Dr. Jane Iverson, who taught at LCCC for many years and has been an active musician in our community for decades, founded the group. And then after that production of A Mall, formed the Chamber Singers formally, and we have been singing for 35 years at this point. I started singing with the group in its second year and sang with them for about 20 years and have been conducting for about 15 now.
Wow. And how many members?
We have floated anywhere from 28 to up to about 40. This year, we're sitting at 31 singers, plus myself and an accompanist.
And I'm guessing there's a lot of longtime members, and how frequently do you get new members?
Well, we do auditions virtually every year. The people that sing with Chamber Singers commit to the entire season, so I usually do auditions in the summer. I've got three or four singers that have been with us 25 plus years. I've got one brand new one this year, actually a Laramie native, that joined us this year. And every year we seem to get a couple folks say, okay, time to retire, or I'm moving, and a few new voices coming in.
Well, tell us about the upcoming performance, November 23rd.
We've got a concert that is going to blend sort of the autumn and the seasonal change for the first half of the concert, and then sort of lean into the holidays, more Advent than Christmas maybe, for the second half. So because of the timing right there before Thanksgiving, didn't want to do a full-blown Christmas concert,
right,
but wanted to at least do some of that.
Sure, sure. We have a selection. Tell us about Bob Chilcott's For Him All Stars Have Shone.
This piece was commissioned by Cheyenne Chamber Singers along with the All City Children's Chorus back in 2001. Bob Chilcott was an original founder of the King Singers. People will remember that group. And this is a piece that's been in our repertoire ever since then. Beautiful song with poetry by Elizabeth Jennings, who was a British writer, a poet in the mid-1900s.
Cheyenne Chamber Singers, For Him All Stars Have Shone, by Bob Chilcott. I'm talking with Sean Ambrose from the Cheyenne Chamber Singers. And another piece in the upcoming concert is called Highland Carol. Tell us about that one.
Highland Carol was originally titled A Christmas Carmen. Ben Alloway was a friend of Jane's, someone that she had worked with, and this was our very first commission that we did for the Cheyenne Chamber Singers. It is a text that combines a lullaby and a very rhythmic. Ben's writing takes a lot of African rhythms and some of the South American styles. This particular one is a lullaby that reflects the Christmas spirit.
Highland Carol from the Cheyenne Chamber Singers, Ben Alloway composition. And the upcoming performance that takes place at St. Mark's Church, correct?
That's correct.
And is that where most or all of the performances take place?
You know, we try and use a variety of venues in Cheyenne and, you know, around the region. St. Mark's is a place we have performed many times, but we try and do a mix of sacred and secular space, and our programming reflects that as well.
I expect the acoustics are pretty good in the church.
They're pretty great there in that particular space.
Yeah. We may have time for another selection, Rachmaninoff. Tell us about this one.
The Bogorodice Djevo by Rachmaninoff is one of the absolute classics of choral literature. It's been performed by virtually every professional and collegiate choir, community choirs. It's part of a series of songs that was part of the All Night Vigil, which Chamber Singers did the full set many years ago. But this work, the English translation of this is Rejoice, O Virgin. This is leaning into Advent, of course, but not specifically Christmas. Beautiful a cappella writing by Rachmaninoff. We are doing it in Russian. Don't ask me to do the translation of everything.
Not.
Thank you.
Chaim Chamber Singers performance coming up as Seasons Change, Songs of Harvest and Holiday. It's November 23rd, 3 p.m., St. Mark's Church in Cheyenne. I've been talking with Sean Ambrose about the 35th anniversary season, and you've got some upcoming performances as well, right?
We do. Along with our performance on the 23rd, we are going to be joining the Children's Chorus for their concert on December 6th. And then we will be doing a joint holiday performance with the Cheyenne Symphony, with the Children's Chorus, on Avant Dance Studios, and Cheyenne Chamber Singers on December 13th at the Cheyenne Civic Center.
Wonderful. And if folks want more information, they can go to your website.
CheyenneChamberSingers.com.
John Ambrose, it's been a pleasure.
Grady, thank you for having me in today.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find it wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Those include Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, X, and Blue Sky. Thanks to Ivy Engel, this episode's audio and digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.